What do I like? And I do love Pizza Hut, and I love the pan pizzas, and I also love Detroit style pizza. So that's what we decided on, is to do Detroit style pizza, where we could focus on just making a really good bread.
When you work for a chef like Jose Andres, you're bound to learn. Spend 15 years with his company, and you're bound to learn a lot. Katsuya Fukushima now runs his own trio of restaurants in Washington, D.C., including one where they're doing a Japanese-Italian Detroit mashup. The story behind Tanari and its wafu approach, straight ahead.
Straight fried pepperoni.
I need a deep dish pepperoni and a thin sausage to go.
Can I get two cheesivores and one Detroit?
Can I get one large pep, one large sausage, and one large pep special?
This is Pizza City, the podcast dedicated to the art, craft, and passion behind the world's greatest pizzas. I'm Steve Dolinsky, author of Pizza City USA, the ultimate Chicago pizza guide, and founder of Pizza City Tours and Pizza City Fest.
Nice. Is that crispy?
And welcome, everybody. Great to have you along with us for another edition of Pizza City. When I met Katsuya Fukushima inside his restaurant Tanari in Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown, I recognized him right away. And then I realized we had dined at Cafe Atlantico many years ago. That was Jose Andres's early, early restaurant down the street from where Haleo is now in the Penn Quarter. And I was pretty sure I'd seen Fukushima there. He ended up working for Andres's Think Food Group for 15 years, a lifetime in kitchen experience, getting to do some amazing stages in Europe, among other fringe benefits. He'll talk about that today. Well, now he oversees Tanari plus two other concepts, which we're going to talk about. But it's at Tanari where he emphasizes a style called Wafu Italian, which is really just Japanese-influenced Italian. Fukushima is our focus in segment one today. Then in segment two, we meet Mary Mendoza, the pastry chef there, who also oversees a five-course dessert bar up on the second floor of Tanari, where just seven guests at a time can sit at the counter. I had a chance to try a couple of her desserts, and they were just pure bliss. But Mary plays a big role in the creation of their Detroit meets Japan pizza, which every pizza lover must try, especially if you're walking around Penn Quarter or Chinatown. Maybe if you're just visiting the museums or whatever as a tourist, leave some time for Tanari. We began our show, as we always do, by asking our guest about his first pizza memory.
My dad was in the military. We were stationed in Fort Ord, California, and it has to be Shakey's Pizza.
No, that's mine. That's my memory.
Shakey's Pizza. And watching from the window outside, you see those people making the pizzas.
Yeah. Shakey's started in the 50s originally in Sacramento, like in 56, I think, but we had it in Minnesota. That was the chain pizza that I had. And you could watch them make the pizza, which was fascinating. And if you describe the style, it's kind of a thin, not tavern style, but just definitely a thin pizza. Yeah.
It was just so much fun because, you know, being Japanese and experiencing pizza for the first time. And who doesn't love pizza? You know what I mean?
Okay, so tell me about your path a little bit. How'd you get into culinary? I know you worked for Jose Andres, which was a big feather in your cap. How did that happen?
I was in culinary school, and my externship was at this really tough spot. The chef's name was Jeffrey Boobin from Vidalia Restaurant. Really got my ass kicked there. And after I finished, I'm like, oh man, I don't know if I want to keep cooking, because it really shook me up. I was like, if this is the way cooking is in this industry, I don't know if I can handle it. And that was back in mid-90s, you know, and now it's even...
That back when it was more normal to be
yes.
sort of tougher on people and yelling at people, right?
Correct. Then my girlfriend's like, you know, you really love cooking. Maybe chefs are different. So I started knocking at doors, and I knocked at the door of this place called Haleo. Spaniard guy came in. He's like, come back tomorrow. I started, and I was with him for 15 years.
Wow. So what was it about that organization that kept you there for so long? You just kept learning, kept growing?
Kept learning, and Jose was, oh my God, I mean, he became one of my best friends, not only my mentor, but one of my best friends. Could definitely, I get kind of choked up saying it, but you know, I owe a lot to him. I'm very, very grateful.
You did a couple different things with him, so not just the Spanish food at Haleo, but Mini Bar, which was kind of his sort of gastronomic tasting menu, El Bui-ish.
Yes.
You did a stage at El Bui, and then you did, I mean, tell me about kind of what else you did besides the Spanish side of that.
I remember at the time, you know, there was no Instagram or all that. And then I remember reading in the New York Times about this place called El Bulli in Spain. And I kept saying, Jose, I want to go there. He's like, no, you're not ready. He kept saying, you're not ready. I'm like, okay. And finally he said, okay, you could go. I set it up for you. And I was like, that's incredible. And he set me up. I went there for a whole season, got to spend some time at the test kitchen in Barcelona, and I mean, that changed my life.
Okay, so along this 15-year path, working for Jose, cooking in these different areas, but you're living in D.C. basically, and you said living for a season in Spain, what was the pizza experience exposure like? Were you just going to late-night pizza places after shift, or were you exploring pizza at all? Because I want to kind of, how did you, you know, steer your way to what you're doing now? What was the pizza experience like along this path?
I never really explored pizza making because I knew that...
It's bread baking,
correct. Bread baking is a whole other art form.
That's the pastry chef's job.
Yes. I mean, bread making is incredibly tough, and it's another rabbit hole. And, you know, now I'm like, oh, my God, people think we just throw dough on a pan and put toppings on, but... Oh my God, every day is different.
Okay, so how did you get to this point where you decide you're gonna leave this operation, this organization, you're gonna open your own place, and this is what you called it, like wafu, sort of Italian,
yes.
Japanese, right? Explain that a little bit.
So wafu is wafu just means Japanese style. So when you say wafu Italian, it means wafu Japanese style Italian. Because you could have wafu Chinese, you could have wafu, which is something that Japanese do very well also.
Like in South America, there's Nikkei, which is Peruvian Japanese, and that's where Nobu comes from, basically, right? But there's not like a delineated Italian-Japanese style that's been established. It's just, you're saying Japanese sort of influenced Italian.
Yes. And, you know, it started, it's still very young. I mean, it started, I think, in the 60s.
So give me an example of that, like pasta with?
Pasta with mentaiko, which is a cod roe spaghetti. And the original one was some American came in with a tin of caviar and said, make me something with this. Because that's very common in Japan. It's like, you bring something to the chef and say, make me something with this. So they made a caviar pasta. But, you know, it's not sustainable. You can't have caviar pasta on the menu. So then they changed it to mentaiko, which is super affordable and tasty. And so that became one of the first wafu dishes, is the mentaiko spaghetti, which we also have here, and it's fantastic.
But in terms of pizza making, I'm surprised you didn't, and by the way, I should note to our listeners, he's wearing a Pizza Hut jacket, which is so on point. Why not do a Neapolitan or, you know, wood-fired oven or something like along those lines and then Japanese-ify it?
We came upon this space. It used to be another pizza or Italian restaurant here. We really didn't want to get rid of this beautiful pizza oven, so we decided let's do Italian, Japanese-Italian. There's no way I could stretch dough. I honestly can't stretch dough. That's another art form on top of making the dough, which is bread making. But
come on, you didn't have the confidence after 15 years with Jose and working under the Adria brothers that you could do this on your own and figure it out?
I could figure it out, but I'm like, okay, what do I like? And I do love Pizza Hut, and I love the pan pizzas, and I also love Detroit-style pizza. So that's what we decided on, is to do Detroit-style pizza, where we could focus on just making a really good bread or dough, and you don't have to worry too much about the stretching and the... Because I was really scared. I was really scared of, like, I watched so much videos on it, and people just stretching dough, and I'm like, I don't know if I could, you know...
You want to kind of, like, set it in the pan, let the fermentation happen, and then just top it and bake it.
Yes.
And not par-bake it.
Not par-bake it. Okay. You know, and I read that and listened to a lot of podcasts saying that a lot of people do par-bake it. But we did some testing and we realized that we like it much better when we do it fresh. We went to Japan, we came back, we opened up really quickly, and then the pandemic hit almost three and a half, four weeks after we opened.
And you had said you'd done this research in Japan, you went to Savoy, you went to like Monk, you went to all these places to check out, but did that influence you in terms of your toppings or your dough? You said you wanted to do Detroit style anyway, so you had your mind made up Detroit style. But was the trip to inspire you for sort of topping combinations?
Well, one, we wanted to see what the pizza scene was like in Japan. You know, a lot of the Japanese chefs go to Europe and learn from the best and come back. And they do things the traditional way. We didn't realize that the pizza in Tokyo was as good as pizza in Italy. Pizza in Japan's fantastic.
Agreed.
And so then we started learning, okay, what are they doing with pasta? What are they doing with pizza? And, you know, one of the places that really intrigued us was a monk in Kyoto. You know, he was putting mackerel on pizza or little baby anchovies on pizza. And, oh, my God.
I saw that at Marumo, too, in Tokyo. Very interesting. All right, well, I want to see what you're going to do with your pizza. You're going to talk about, you got your mentaiko maybe and your corn thing going with your Detroit style. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking with Katsuya Fukushima here at Tonari in Washington, D.C., right across from the Capital One building, or the home of the Wizards and the Capitals play. We're going to see him make some Japanese-style pizza, and then we're going to also preview some scenes from our next show coming up in 2 weeks. So stay with us. Welcome back to the show. We're here at Tonari in Washington, D.C., right across the street from the Capital One Arena where the Wizards and the Capitals play. This is a great neighborhood, by the way. And we're with Katsuya Fukushima, executive chef here. And you've brought your chef de cuisine slash pastry chef into the mix here. What is her name?
Mary.
Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Okay, so tell us first, before you finish topping that, Mary, let's slow down a little bit. We're not service here. It's before we open, so it's slow down.
Sorry.
Talk about the dough a little bit. Where's the flour from?
From Hokkaido, which is in Sapporo, northern part of Japan. It's very, how I describe it in terms of its strength, something that is between all-purpose and bread flour.
Is this what they use to make like the milk bread, the Japanese milk bread sandwiches?
Yes, so actually we are starting to do production of that for our cafe. So we use the Hokkaido flour for all sorts of things. So we use it in our pizza dough, we use it in our pasta, and from time to time when we have time to play around, like our chocolate cake and the milk bread.
Delicious donut in our sister restaurant with the Hokkaido flour.
Tell me about the sister restaurants you've got here too. There's a next door, there's ramen.
So next door we have Daikaya, which has a Daikaya Izakaya and Daikaya Ramen. And around the corner we have Bantam King, which used to be a Burger King, so we kept the BK. And so it's Bantam King, Japanese fried chicken, and chicken ramen.
Okay, so back to the dough. A lot of hydration in this?
No.
60%?
60%.
Okay, good guess.
It's 59, actually.
Yeah, all right. And then do you do a bulk ferment, or you ball it, and then
Wait, did you know that just from looking at the dough?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's not my first rodeo, guys. But overnight ferment? Cold?
48 hours in 48. Cold. Yeah, in
okay.
The fridge.
Okay. And then you pan it out and let it come to room temperature, I'm guessing, in the pan probably for a bit?
Yes, about, depending on the weather, also in the temperature, between 2 to 4 hours.
Now you're topping it with the cheese, and what do you have?
So we have our dough, we have brick cheese from Wisconsin, we use Great Lakes.
Yeah, brick is the old school way to do it. You've got, and this is, I'm guessing, a Lloyd pan?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a 10 by 8?
Yes, 10
okay.
by 8, wow. All
right. Again, you see these a lot, you know, when people want to go into the Detroit world, they get these pans. And so you've got this shred, it's a pretty, it's a medium shred, and you've placed it everywhere, there's really good coverage. Do you weigh this out? You're taking it out of a deli, but do you weigh it?
Yes, we do, 8 ounces.
Okay, eight ounces.
This is going with Mary's science background.
Everything's weight.
Everything's weight, by the grams.
Okay, now tell me about this sauce is interesting. I saw a chef making this online, but take us through what the process to make this corn sauce is.
So we take canned corn, which is chef's favorite. We use it everywhere. Canned corn, we drain it, and then after we drain it, so when we first started working with this, the consistency was iffy. So again, I go back, I started weighing it. So we do 44% liquid to the corn kernels. Then we blend that. After we blend that, we cook it in the pot. And then after we cook it in the pot, we strain it so you get that really nice, silky, smooth texture.
No butter added?
No butter added.
Okay.
Just corn.
Just cook it down and get it thicken a bit.
Exactly.
Okay, so now you've got this here in your deli, and you're going to just spoon on this sauce on top as if it were the tomato sauce.
Right. Exactly, yep.
This is like liquid polenta.
God, it looks great. I love anything corn. Whenever I see corn on a menu, that's like my... I see corn cakes, I see cornbread, I see Johnny cakes. I got to get it. I just love corn so much. So kind of a rough, again, kind of eyeballing it, an ounce or two of sauce over it. And now what?
Now we're doing the corn kernels on top. So
these are just canned corn.
Yes.
It's not like some Amish farmer in Bethesda that's growing this with like... No, it's just canned corn.
Canned corn. You know how chefs think about balance? So I know it's like, oh, everything's sweet, sweet, sweet. But with when the mentaiko comes into play, you get that salt from the mentaiko, the sourness from the labneh, and then we like resuscitate it with freshness with the chives. So.
Okay, so this is going to go in the oven now just at this point?
Yes.
Okay, and you're using a wood stone here. It's a gas assist?
Yes, it is.
Although you don't use any wood, so it is just a gas-fired oven.
Yeah.
Okay, how hot about...
So we do, our ideal temperature is 480. There are times with like people coming in and out of the restaurant, like it's really weird how sensitive things are. So we try to put the metal panels when we're cooking. So if it gets too hot, we like put it further away from the flame. But I kind of like putting it like just about like kissing the flame this much in the middle. And then this is our... Here on the side are worn out like instructions on like when to turn. So we would 12 minutes.
Setting it for 12?
Yep.
Ooh. Okay. We'll come back in 12 minutes to do the post-bake topping. Oh God, that's glorious. Nice frico on the edge.
No frico broken.
Wait, show Steve.
Yeah, look at that. Beautiful,
that's
even
nice.
Browning, caramelization. I want to get a picture of that too. That's gorgeous. Yep. Got a little mezzaluna here. She's cutting it into fours or sixes?
Fours.
Fours. Those are big slices. This is for one person? Come on. This is a lot for one person.
No, it's for a family.
Okay. All right. So now comes what? This is the labneh?
This is the mentaiko labneh, correct.
Oh, mentaiko. So you mix the mentaiko, the cod roe, with labneh, which is kind of like a Greek yogurt, yeah?
Yes. But, you know, a lot of people would beg to differ that labneh is its own thing. It's almost like cheese.
Spreading this with a squeeze bottle diagonally across the pizza.
Yeah, and then shower it with some chives.
Beautiful.
And that's it?
Yes, that's it.
And you've got even coverage, which is always impressive. One of the things I talk about, you know, sort of OBR, optimal bite ratio, you want every bite to have crust, cheese, sauce, topping. And so in this case, you've got crust, cheese, sauce, topping in pretty much every bite, it looks like. All right, we're going to take
OBR,
that. Optimal bite. Oh, you never heard that before?
No.
Optimal what?
Optimal bite ratio.
Wow, I like that. So when I think about it, it's like chef also loves to bartend. When you make a cocktail, it's like one sip. So it's like... Optimal bite ratio, like when you take
optimal
one
drink ratio.
Yeah, because you don't want to have like a stuffed pizza from Chicago, which is the one that gets maligned mostly. You get a lot of crust or a lot of cheese, and I don't want to have that. I want to have, you know, crust, cheese, sauce topping every bite. So I'm gonna bite into this. We'll get a quick musical interlude. We'll come back in a second. Chef, you brought up a word I was interested in. You said mochi. For that texture, and you're absolutely right. It's chewy and a little bit crunchy.
That's what was very unique about this flour. We did a lot of testing in Hokkaido with this flour factory that we did a lot of iterations of this dough with Canadian flour, American flour, Hokkaido flour, different combinations of. And unfortunately, we loved the one that was 100% Hokkaido flour. Which makes it more expensive, but...
Right. So how much does that add to your bottom line? You got to charge more for a pizza.
We do, but we don't charge what we should be charging just because we want people to enjoy this pizza and experience it because...
Well, clearly, four people could enjoy this pizza and have another dish or two from here.
Yes.
So what's a pizza cost here, this one?
What's that one there? It's like 20-something?
23, 25.
Totally reasonable, guys.
Yes,
totally reasonable.
Very reasonable.
Yeah,
and then we do happy hour Monday to Friday, 5 to 7, 50% off pizza.
That's
That's just going to be an unbelievable deal. People should be running in here from Roanoke. They should be driving in here for dinner.
Well, ours always packed from 5 to 7 to just 50% pizza. So we just want people to experience it.
With a Toki highball. Let's talk about the topping. So you talked about there's that sweetness from the corn, which is natural, of course, but then you brought in the saltiness from the mentaiko and a little bit of, I mean, the labneh, I would think, have a little richness, but it's almost tangy, right?
Yeah. It's like a contrast, you know, with like the salt and then acid from the labneh, even though it's not that much, but the salt highlights that lactic acid, all those natural things that come with labneh.
And I think as nice as the chives add color, you do need that little oniony to also balance it out, right?
Yeah, because onion has some bitterness to it, so it rounds it out. I know people hate that word, but when we think about food, we want things to be balanced so that it's not overwhelming. People don't fall asleep on the bench, you know.
But you got sweet, you got bitter, you got acid. I mean,
how much do you guys think about umami? Because that is such a part of the Japanese experience also.
So it's funny that you asked that. When I was in college, I was a researcher, and G-protein coupled receptors, umami. So when people think about MSG, they freak out. But people don't understand that MSG, their natural MSG in cheese, in tomatoes, even dry-aged steak, it has natural MSG. And when your mouth feels that, it gets activated, because when you take MSG, it breaks down in your mouth into glutamic acid, and that's where umami comes along.
Yeah, there's so much negative press about that from the 70s and 80s. In fact, the chef
lost me on that one.
But the chef at Bonnie's in Brooklyn, I know, has really embraced MSG because it was so maligned in the past, and it's not something that's bad for you. Those natural glutamates are important. But umami is that sort of fullness, roundness, savoriness, such an important part of what Japanese cuisine is. Do you guys add dashi? Do you make a dashi here for any of your pizzas? Is that part of what you do?
We don't do as much dashi in our pizza, mostly in our pasta.
We do have a dashi in our gyudon pizza.
Yes, that one.
A gyudon pizza? The beef?
Yes.
Tongue? No.
Sliced beef, really thin, stewed with onions and dashi and soy.
Okay.
And we have a gyudon pizza, so it's usually served on top of rice, but we do it with pizza, and we serve it with cheese whiz. So it's like Japan meets Philly on a pizza dough.
I think that is the most beloved pizza in the menu after the mentaiko, because the way it got introduced into the menu was so natural. It was back in the Super Bowl. It was the Phillies versus the Kansas City Chiefs. And then people were like, oh, this pizza should stay because it's American, it's Japanese, and it's Italian all together. It's like the pizza for everyone. So it's still on the menu.
All right, final question for both of you. You can either answer together or individually. We ask all our guests on the show, knowing what you know now about pizza making, what would you have told your younger self, let's say in 2019, before you opened this place, to be successful when it comes to pizza making? What advice would you give your younger self to be successful about pizza making? Mary or Katsuya?
Ooh, that's a tough question.
It's a tough show.
Patience is a virtue. If the dough's not ready, don't force it.
Okay, same?
It's a tough thing.
Yeah. Be patient?
Be patient. And hopefully people would understand the patience involved in making this. So,
restaurant again is called Tonari. What neighborhood are we in, by the way, guys?
We are in Chinatown, right in the cusp of Penn Quarters, but we're in Chinatown.
Okay, very easy to get to off the train. I took the yellow line from the airport and got right off at Gallery Place. Super easy. Come see Mary and Katsuya. Really a special little place here at Tonari. I'm so excited to keep diving into this pizza. Thank you guys so much. Or as we would say, arigato gozaimasu.
Hiya, boom.
Thank you so much.
Okay, coming up in 2 weeks, we're flying back across the country, heading all the way west to San Francisco, where a couple of guys are making New York-style pizza.
I think that's like the fun thing about having like us both worked at like Mr. Zhu's, having an idea of like what we can like do to elevate a certain dish or whatnot.
I'll talk with the team behind Out of Sight in the Tenderloin. That's in 2 weeks on February 16th. Remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, tell a friend, and rate us, please. Also, reminder, support the show at anchor.fm/pizzacity. We're at Pizza City USA on Instagram, and our website is pizzacityusa.com. Bureaucratic wrote and performed our theme song, and here's wishing you an optimal bite ratio, always.